You're listening to the CyberWire Network, powered by N2K.
And now, a word from our sponsor, Zscaler, the leader in cloud security. Cyber attackers are using AI in creative ways to compromise users and breach organizations. In a security landscape where you must fight AI with AI, the best AI protection comes from having the best data. Zscaler has extended its Zero Trust architecture with powerful AI engines that are trained and tuned by 500 trillion daily signals. Learn more about Zscaler Zero Trust plus AI to prevent ransomware and AI attacks. Experience your world secured. Visit zscaler.com/zerotrustAI.
Hi, and welcome to Spycast, from the secret files of the International Spy Museum in Washington, D.C. I'm Dr. Vince Houghton, the museum's historian and curator. Every week, Spycast brings you interesting conversations with authors, scholars, and practitioners who live in the world of global espionage. If you have any questions, comments, or concerns about Spycast, or if you want to suggest someone who might be a good future guest, email us at spycast@spymuseum.org. That's spycast@spymuseum.org. Also, if you like what you hear, and even if you don't, please take a minute to review us on iTunes or whatever platform you might be listening. We're always looking for ways to make Spycast better, and you can help. So let me actually introduce you formally instead of doing this. Her name is Emily Krause. I'm just joking. It's Emily Krause. We had a 20-minute conversation about how our names get constantly butchered. She is a cybersecurity researcher and practitioner focusing on defending critical infrastructure against cyber attacks around the world. She's over a decade working in the national security cybersecurity field, including 7 years working for the National Security Agency, the Central Intelligence Agency, and INSCOM, which is the United States Army's Intelligence Security Command. She's also an advocate for the inclusion of women, persons of color, and LGBT in discussions about personal privacy, security, and government transparency. And like I said, she was very, very nice to volunteer her time to help us build this new museum and to help us bring this topic, which is so misunderstood, to our visitors. I mean, to talk about somebody who knows this field better than anybody. And so welcome, and thank you for joining us
here
at SpyCast.
Thanks for having me.
Of course. So let's start with you, because I think that you have a really interesting background that you don't tend to see a lot of. You look like you're 19, but you're not. I won't say how old you actually are. But you've been doing this for quite some time.
I can't drive and drink.
Drive and drink and rent a car. So what got you into the field? Because you broke bad at some point. You were doing you're going in a great direction. You were studying history in college. You're going to be a history teacher. And then you started selling meth. I mean, you went into cyber. I don't know what happened. You just went in a bad direction.
What made you go to
the dark side?
So the real answer there is less about meth and more about how I realized it's at a certain point that I really wanted to be a part of history and actually do something that helps move history in a direction rather than talk about history. I love history. It's one of my favorite topics, always has been. Nothing against the historians. Now I participate in a different way. My interest kind of pre-existed. I've always been involved in it to some degree with security and just decided to make that professional thing instead.
Well, what made you decide to go government versus doing hacktivism or working on your own? I mean, there's so many opportunities to be part of a conglomerate, whether it's something as far out of field as Anonymous or, you know, more of like White Hat Hackers or others. You went NSA, right? You went the kind of government, the man route.
I did.
Like, what pushed you in that direction versus others? Because now you're the opposite to a degree.
Yeah. I don't know. I think there was definitely an interest to understand that world better, and it might have something to do with my interest in history, because these agencies touch historic topics so much that they drive so much of the topic that it's almost hard to avoid it. Any part of history where, especially modern history, where intelligence isn't involved is actually kind of hard to find a component of modern society that hasn't been impacted.
Well, tell us everything you did at CIA.
Oh, I will definitely tell you every part. So there's obviously a directive not to speak on anything specific, but the U.S. government obviously has a stake in cybersecurity and in defense and for national security reasons. So there is a cybersecurity component to intelligence that is growing and increasingly important in the modern age, because everybody puts some information that's sensitive about them in some kind of computer system. And it's just a matter of figuring out how to retrieve that information that's up to governments and even private industries to resource from those machines. And there's all kinds of ways to do that, but it's definitely within the wheelhouse of governments to be involved in that as well.
From when you started, how much did you see things change along the way? I know we've had now the creation of Cyber Command. Mm-hmm. We've had the creation of the Office of the Director of National Intelligence, which is around the time that you got into the business. And obviously, even if it was before or after, there's been so much transition, so much change that's gone on, and how these agencies work with each other.
Yep.
As I mentioned, you work for three different major big agencies doing cyber work. How, in the 7 years you worked directly for the government, what kind of evolution did you see through that time?
Yeah, there's so many evolutions. Even in the 7 years that I was there, the amount of change that came about just from all aspects of understanding cyber, there's too much to get into any one specific thing. But if I had to choose one, it might be the understanding of cyber, the concept of cyber warfare and disinformation, especially since 2016. That's been kind of a big thing. So there's been an evolution on the topic of how that impacts social aspects, maybe a bit more than this general idea of, and I'm kind of switching gears, hard gears here, but the way that war kind of evolves is it starts, you have to come from something that you understand. So people hitting each other with sticks, to hitting each other with swords, to doing basically the same thing, but with guns in a field. So the idea of cyber warfare comes from this evolution of, everybody's heard the term cyber bullets or cyber bombs, and we all kind of laugh in the industry because it's not the same thing. The concept does not fold properly. So the evolution and understanding of what a cyber tool is or a cyber weapon is actually something that you can kind of see evolving in real time right now, which I think is really fascinating because it's history happening right now.
Well, what's interesting to me, so I'm of a generation that grew up with nuclear weapons as the transformative technology. And there's such an interesting parallel between the early years of nuclear power and now we're kind of in the early years of cyber, in that the bosses, the policymakers, the generals, the high-ups have no idea what the hell they're talking about, what's going on. And so this young gun group came in, Rand and some of these think tanks in the 1940s and 50s, some of the physicists who had worked on the Manhattan Project, who were in their 20s, and they were the experts. They actually started creating policy and developing policy. You're seeing the same thing today, where, I mean, Barack Obama, for being the young, hip president, didn't have a clue.
Yeah.
And let's not get into other presidents and other policymakers about their knowledge on what's going on in the world, but if you look at
those
accounts,
I don't know who you're
talking about
personally.
But even generals in the military, there are some that are very tuned in, like Mike Rogers, who just retired as NSA chief in Cyber Command, but very few. How difficult is that? Because dissemination of intelligence is always hard. Right, talking to policymakers about what intelligence means and why they should pay attention to it, even if you're talking about how good a tank is or how a person's going to act a certain way. But now you're talking about the cyber and the magical world. Was that something that was constantly on your mind about, okay, we can do intelligence really well, but how the hell are we going to get these people to understand what we're doing?
Yes. Well, I was just a cog in the wheel, of course. So my opinions don't matter. In this room, they do. So fantastic on me for being here. And thank you for inviting me. But the abstract concept of what cyber is, the way that we were just alluding to it, it's abstract. It isn't a bomb. You don't wield the same type of power with a nuclear weapon that you do with information. It operates in a very different paradigm. So when you understand how that function works and what you can do with it, then you can actually start to adapt it to something that's more weaponizable. Some countries do that better than others. Some commanders do that better than others, but it's all a matter of understanding where that fits in the modern arsenal. That we are not quite there yet, I don't think, in the United States. But that is part of the evolution, as you asked a moment ago. Where are we at? We're there. We're trying to figure out how we use this.
Well, 2016 was an extraordinary moment, as you mentioned, because the beginning of that operation wasn't that different. Breaking into a system and stealing information. Right? I mean, that's what CREEP did in 1972 at Watergate, right? They just did it in a very different
low-tech way.
That's what we've been doing since the beginning of time. That is intelligence collection.
Yes.
Is stealing information that somebody doesn't want you to have.
Yep.
I think what the difference was they weaponized the information.
Yes.
And that's really one of the first times we've seen that, where information was stolen and then used against us. In the community, was that a watershed moment? I mean, was that a kind of point where everyone said the rules of the game have changed?
It's certainly become more of a discussion point on the outside of government. That's where I've been having most of these discussions. Because when I was with the government, that there wasn't much research being done. I mean, I'm sure there was research being done. I was not a part of it. But the discussion on the outside has certainly been how, since 2016, what do we do now? How do we as the public process this information? And is there anything that private industry can do or has to do? And what's the role of government in all of this? It's taken a long time to try and figure that out. And we are just not even, I feel like we're not even close.
Well, I mean, it almost seems like a losing battle where people who are information security, I've heard a lot of people talk about, well, you're never going to keep everybody out.
Right.
So it's about mitigating damage,
right?
It's about creating fake folders and fake files. And that almost seems like we've given up the war before it even started. The idea of like, how can we prevent getting cleaned out completely instead of keeping people out? And so it very quickly went from, you know, like McAfee antivirus and keep the bad guys out to how do we make it to where they don't make our company go broke overnight?
Yeah. Well, it's a different interplay between the way that private industry does things and the way that the government does things. I mean, certainly a lot of the same security concepts apply. You know, we talk like defense in depth is one of these concepts that's like way too deep to get into right now. But it is a concept that applies on the defense of information. But how it gets used when it leaves your control is certainly something that is it's a difficult point to contend with. And we, you know, see that all the time with every big breach that occurs. How can a government or how can a company do anything with that? The Capital One breach is a great one that just happened a couple weeks ago. What happens when 16 million customers lose their information? What happens when that leaves the control of a company? I guess we'll watch your background check for you for a little while and get you some protection. But like that lasts a year, and that information has a permanent value to it. So there's very limited amount that a company even can do these days.
Well, there's a limited amount that a government can do. Let's talk about government versus state cyber attacks, because we're at a point, again, going back to the nuclear policy angle, is what kept World War III from happening, according to a lot of people, was this concept of deterrence, right? Strategic deterrence. We've got nukes, you've got nukes. The whole world will end if anyone starts a war.
Right.
Deterrence in the cyber realm is far more difficult. In many respects, it's because how the hell do we know where it's coming from?
Right?
How do we deter an adversary if the adversary can hit us and we can't actually attribute that attack to someone?
Yeah.
I mean, look at, you know, Stuxnet's a great example of this. I don't know, you were in the business, so you can only talk so much about Stuxnet in one way or the other, but everyone kind of understands that if it had been done right, no one would have ever heard that word before. And it was only because it was a mistake that it became public. And there's no way that it would have been attributable to anyone except for the screw-up. And you can imagine how much of that is happening, to where we get hit something big, the government loses a lot of information, we have no idea who did it. How hard is it today to do attribution, to actually know who came after you?
Attribution is a combination of an art and a science, and there are about as many opinions as there are people who practice it. There seems to be a mistaken notion that we can just find whoever did whatever and we can make them pay. And it just really doesn't work like that in the real world. There's too much complexity to really be able to say with a high degree of certainty who did what. Now, there are some techniques, I'm sure, that governments have that they can get a better beat on this. But not everybody has that kind of capability. One example that just recently happened was the Israeli bombing of a Hamas hacker group that occurred. And that was interesting because they were so sure that they were operating out of a specific location, they dropped a bomb on the building. And it didn't surprise a whole lot of people who work in cyber, because we all kind of see ourselves as being potential targets in this space. We're an extension of war fighters. Mm-hmm. When you work for the government, you have to assume that you're a part of that target set. So the attribution angle is something that we if you want to do anything reciprocal, you have to get right. And not everybody has the guts to take direct action on that issue.
Right. I mean, you talked about that case as basically a kinetic response, right? Kind of the fancy way of saying take it out of the cyber world and actually kill somebody.
Right.
Even with something like digital forensics, which is kind of the big buzzword where you look at like a WannaCry and you can take individual lines of code and match it up with the same lines of code and go, right, this is the same person,
yes,
who wrote this. Even if we track something back to Moscow, mm-hmm, a block away from the Kremlin, Putin can be like, I don't know who this is.
Right.
This could just be a patriotic Russian who is attacking. You can't say it was the Russian government. You
right.
can't put it on them. So yeah, we're not going to drop a bomb down the chimney of the Kremlin,
right,
because there's absolutely no way to prove that.
Right.
And we outsource, and this is, again, you may not be able to confirm or deny this because of government, we outsource some of our operations as well to where there is this old school idea of plausible deniability. Of the idea is, you know, it's clear if it's coming from Fort Meade that the NSA is behind something. But we're not dumb enough to do it that way, and the Russians aren't, and the Chinese aren't, and everybody else around the world is too. So when you talk about attribution, how do you counterattack? How do you hack back? How do you actually do something that will deter people from happening again? Because you hear that buzzword, right? That's
right.
The thing, and everyone gets on the president, and God knows I do too, but the whole idea of you got to send the Russians a message that if they do this in 2020, well, how?
Yeah.
Right? How do you make it to where they're too afraid to do it again?
Right.
Because it worked pretty damn well the first time.
Yeah. There's so much, and again, I'm not operating at that level necessarily, but there's so much geopolitics that goes into the responsive messaging in that kind of situation. And in the past, it seems like the messaging has been the only way that you really can respond to it. We have a military doctrine that says that we could potentially respond kinetically to something like this, but when do you test that?
Right.
When do you actually decide that it's time to actually let a bomb off the trigger a bomb against somebody? It's not the easiest decision to make when the attribution for stuff like this is fuzzy sometimes. And even when you have certainty, there's still the geopolitics comes back
right.
into it. Is it really worth having responding to something kinetically, where then you've just opened the door to a responsive kinetic attack, and where is that going to occur?
Right.
There's just so many angles. It's hard to even find the desire to open that door.
Well, you mentioned, and I think a lot of people may not know this, is that it is stated DoD policy and national policy that if there's a cyber attack on critical infrastructure,
right,
we will treat that as a kinetic attack.
Right.
And in some cases, if it's hardcore,
yeah,
we will treat that as a potential for a full, big-time retaliatory response.
Right.
And there are people that even talked about nuclear response in
right.
some cases if it's a big... That's stated DoD policy.
Right.
Opening that can of worms, like, it's one of these things where if you look back again at the Cold War, mm-hmm, and the idea of, you know, if we hit them with 3 or 4 nukes, the only way they can respond is to send everything they have and then everybody dies.
Right.
Who is willing to do that? But you have to, at least for deterrence to work, you have to have a credible threat.
Right.
That to me is now we're in the psychological realm
right.
of things we didn't really want to be
yeah.
after the Cold War ended.
Right. Yeah. You don't want to be in the position of having to respond to something like that, especially with, God forbid, nuclear weapons. But the critical infrastructure is a really good point, because there's so much to that. Like, where does it start and where does it end? There's obviously stated critical infrastructure that the United States cares about. I personally would say that the civilization depends on my top three things. Civilization depends on clean water, electricity, and candy. And if you bomb my candy factory, we're going to have issues.
That's not necessarily the paradigm of needs, but that's fine. You know what? You can have your own. Perfectly fine. Let me ask you you mentioned this idea of kind of private industry, and we talked about the government. I want to talk about this relationship between the two. And you've been asked 1,000 questions, I'm sure, before about the public-private partnership. But I want to ask you I want to talk about the community itself, the community of people who do what you do. Because the movies have it, like, all hackers know everybody else. You know, it's all one, you know, everyone has everyone else's number.
Right.
And I kind of joked about that. And then we've had conversations. We're like, oh, I know that guy. Yeah. I know them. I'm like, oh, the movies are real. So this is kind of true also. But what I wonder about is, has the community gotten bad almost like the gaming community has, where the incels have come and, like, there's been kind of this pushback? Because there had been a mentality of people who did hacktivism, people who were in this community, were all about egalitarianism.
Right.
Were actually, you know, I was going to ask you about the idea of, you're a very outspoken advocate of LGBTQ, mm-hmm. The community, and how that jived with you being in the Army, working for the Army and for CIA and other things like that. But I wonder if the community is kind of starting to go on that path, that the gaming community and some of the, because there's a lot of crossover in the two, of kind of starting to push back against being as open and as, let's use the word, liberal.
Well, I would say that in general, my experience with people has been overwhelmingly positive and outstandingly positive. I was actually just talking with a colleague in the InfoSec industry. Shout out to Dave Kennedy. So we were talking about the kind of evolution of the community and the way that people interact socially. And the weirdest thing to me is that we've been doing a lot of the things that people are doing now for a long time. Memes, before they became a popular thing, was something that we did in the InfoSec community probably 15, 20 years ago. We've been doing inside jokes like that and trading them on the internet for as long as I've been doing it. But at a certain point, this exploded into the mainstream. All of the things that we used to joke among ourselves pre-2016 suddenly became everybody else's humor and everybody else's way of communicating. And it's really, in some ways, it's unsettling to see the kind of the good, bad, and the ugly all become everybody's, a part of everybody's experience. And it's bizarre for me personally. I don't know if anyone else experiences the same reaction to that as I do in the community.
But it also kind of overlaps the idea that since 9/11 at least, that about how intelligence has become so well understood, or at least known by the general public, because every front page of every newspaper since 9/11 has had some kind of an intelligence story on it, whether it's about drones or Snowden or something else. And cyber has been a big part of that too, where even before 2016, all of a sudden it's mainstream. All of a sudden people think they know a little bit about it, or, you know, someone like you who could probably gone through their entire life anonymously is kind of thrust into the limelight.
Sometimes
the thing is, you know, all of a sudden, everyone from Edward Snowden and Chelsea Manning, I'm not just talking about them, but the people on the other side too, who probably 15 years ago, no one would have ever known their names, are now thrust into this prominent position because people understand, or at least they it's much more mainstream than it was before.
Right. Yeah, it is. It's definitely a weird adaptation that we've had to make, certainly socially. I know within the InfoSec community, there is a certain undercurrent of fame even among InfoSec people, but it's kind of weird that there's so much recognition even among people who aren't in the community.
Let me ask you, one thing you decided to do is kind of take it upon yourself to do something what I thought was fantastically good for the community. And this is kind of how we met almost in the beginning, is you kind of reached out and said, hey, I'm doing this thing. I think it's really kind of cool. The Spy Museum might be interested in it. And it was right on the heels of the Googles of the world and others saying, we can't control, and they still are saying this, we can't control and police what is being put on Facebook and Twitter.
Right.
Because there's no way that anyone can build an algorithm or any kind of system that will automatically find like white supremacist memes or neo-Nazi or anything else. We don't have enough people to go through and find all the tweets and find all the Facebook posts. And years ago, you said that's bullshit.
Yeah.
That I don't have enough people to do it either, but I can train a computer to do it for me.
Yeah.
And that's where Nemesis came from. Can you please talk about this?
Yeah.
This, to me, this is, you sent this to me and I'm like, holy Jesus, this is one person doing this.
Right.
Now you've branched it out. But.
Yeah. Well, it's funny that you bring it up in that context because the technology that I use is actually Google Tech. So it's not necessarily that they can't or don't have the technology to do it. It's a bit more complex than that. A part of it is the will, that they don't necessarily have the will to police it. But it does take a lot of care and feeding. Anyway, Nemesis is this thing that I developed back in 2017, just after Charlottesville. We used to call them crypto-fascists. You don't have that term as much as you did in 2017 because, unfortunately, they don't need to be crypto anymore, which has kind of made my whole tool obsolete at this point. I took this technology called TensorFlow and I adapted it to be able to look for patterns and imagery that are associated with white nationalist symbolism. So if there's a swastika in the picture, my technology can find it. You just provide the picture and it will put a little colorful box around it and tell you what it is. It was great technology at the time to play with because those symbols aren't always known by everybody. So you could put any given picture into it, and if you didn't know what symbol it was, it would tell you. Now there's not so much of a need to use hidden encrypted, so to speak, language. You can just kind of say whatever you want to, and there's no real consequence for it, which is more unfortunate even than I feel like 2017 had.
Well, I mean, this was, swastika, it went beyond that. You know, things that were a little bit, way more obscure that were inside of other symbols or things that you look at and be like, oh, what's the big deal about that?
Right.
It's like, well, the big deal is that this was used by the Nazis and all the things like that, too. I mean, that to me, you did it by yourself, whereas these massive companies were saying it was impossible to do. Did they see what you were doing and any kind of pushback or acceptance? I know certainly within the community, people loved what you were doing. You got a lot of really great kudos from the community. What about those companies? What about the people who you're kind of saying, stop lying to everybody. You could easily do this.
Well, I did have two great devs that were helping me out on the technology side. On the company side, I think I may have had one person reach out to me representing social media. My understanding was that they had been working on projects of their own. I'm certain that they have something now. I don't know what it is, but there is room for them to be doing more of this. I think they're doing an okay job now, but we only know how the extent of the technology that they employ and how well they're doing until something happens on their platform, unfortunately. And just recently, there's been even more controversy about other forums that are even less policed than the big ones that we know about, constantly facing down criticism and having to jump from internet service provider to content data network provider just to avoid having their service get pulled. So it's an ongoing battle for these people, and I really hope that they're put against the ropes as long as we can continue that.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, is it an advantage that you talked about how bad it is, and I agree with you that they've become so much more bold and, you know, not having to hide anymore about being so overtly racist.
Yeah.
That kind of puts a target on them a little bit more, though, too.
Yes.
I mean, it makes it easier in many respects to say, all right, you want to come out and be like at your Klan rally?
Yeah.
Great. You just painted a target on your back.
Yeah.
I mean, is there a kind of a double-edged sword for them in that respect?
I think there is. I don't have the comfort that some people have in saying, well, I'm glad that Charlottesville happened because now everybody's out in public and they have to admit to this. I don't have that kind of casual relationship with saying that. I would prefer for people to be able I would prefer for people to own their beliefs and to have to be held accountable for them. Socially, these people have drawn maybe more attention than they intended to themselves, but it's only because they've been empowered to by people in leadership. So it's now incumbent upon all of us. We are all nemesis now. We all own this responsibility, this chunk of responsibility to say this isn't acceptable and we are going to push back on this. So I'm glad that it's taken out of the hands of technology and put into the hands of people that can actually do something about it.
Hey everybody, today I want to highlight a name that all of us know well, and that is our sponsor, Splunk. You need to keep operations humming around the clock, but potential disruptions are everywhere. Splunk helps you predict problems and find and fix issues fast so you can reduce risk and ditch downtime. The world's largest enterprises rely on Splunk's unified security and observability platform to become more efficient, resilient, and innovative. With Splunk, you can react quickly, evolve faster, and be ready for anything. Stay ahead of disruptions. Learn more at splunk.com/resilience. And we thank Splunk for sponsoring our show. The IT world used to be simpler. You only had to secure and manage environments that you controlled. Then came new technologies and new ways to work. Now, employees, apps, and networks are everywhere. This means poor visibility, security gaps, and added risk. That's why Cloudflare created the first-ever connectivity cloud. Visit cloudflare.com to protect your business everywhere you do business.
Let's talk about hands of technology. Because what you kind of were doing a little bit was a really kind of embryonic form of artificial intelligence, and that word gets thrown around, that phrase.
Oh God!
And
you
everyone
said it. You
either
said it,
either
Vince.
People think Skynet and the Terminator, or they think of the fact that when I post a picture of my cat, Facebook tags it as my dog, or it tags it as my sister.
The classic cat
yeah,
dog
right?
problem.
It's like,
yeah.
Oh well, I'm sorry, Kim, my sister, but Elwood the cat was tagged by Facebook because it's too goddamn dumb to know that it's not a cat. So, you know, there's that literally in the same day you go from Facebook AI looking ridiculous to concepts of Skynet.
Yeah.
Obviously, we're somewhere in between.
Yeah.
Is artificial intelligence the big next thing, or is it stuff like implantable technology or, you know, what people talk about like human-machine hybrid? And again, that sounds like cyborg kind of thing like that, but we're almost there. We're practically there already in many respects.
There's so many fronts of what the next big thing is. Artificial intelligence is one of those things that's really creeping up on us, and it's happening more and more in ways that we don't really fully see all the time. Facial recognition is one of those kind of like points where we start to see the technology really being used more and more frequently and relied on more and more frequently. Every time I see a facial recognition technology being used to verify somebody's identity, I kind of cringe because I've seen how the technology is used and where it fails. And I don't personally think it's ready. But we do have to watch those things and understand how they work because they're going to be a part of our lives very soon. Implantable technology is another one of those things where we have, if you are under any delusion that we don't have cyborgs right now, we do. There is technology being implanted in people's bodies all the time and in growing numbers. And it's changing all kinds of things. It may take more time before we see it happening on a social level, but it's certainly technology that is going to be shaping the way that to bring the discussion full circle, it's certainly technology that's going to be shaping the future of intelligence collection and intelligence management. All of those pieces are going to be impacted deeply by both of those technologies.
Well, I mean, look at covert action. I mean, there's the story of Dick Cheney. I mean, I read the networked pacemaker.
Yes.
Where, if you know this story or not, Dick Cheney had a very, very modern pacemaker put in that had the capability of a network connection so that the doctor could actually basically look at how the pacemaker was doing over the time. And Cheney, rightly so, said, you got to turn that off, right? Because what if my pacemaker is hacked?
Yeah.
I mean, talk about the greatest covert action in history.
That would
because
have been
no one would have blinked twice if Cheney collapsed from a heart attack.
Right.
I mean, Cheney is more machine than man now anyway, right? It would have been like, oh, Dick Cheney died of a heart attack. But it could have been a covert action. I mean, you look at that now where insulin pumps more than ever before are now being networked to where there can be a machine with intelligence that can track your blood sugar levels and tweak your insulin. Imagine hacking that and just dumping, you know, insulin into the body. You could kill somebody that way. And that's just stuff I can think of, right? I'm not devious enough to really come up with the bad stuff.
Yeah.
But groups like IARPA and DARPA and others are doing these when it comes to getting soldiers more capable of battle. And that's not just about machines also. That's about drugs and other things that make it to where you don't need to eat for 4 days.
Right.
You don't need to sleep for a week and other things like that, too. That's going to have huge implications on the way intelligence is done.
Yeah. I mean, we've been on that path since World War II, just modifying your body function through drugs and other means. The whole healthcare information security is a very interesting topic because it's another one of those features that doesn't get talked a whole lot about. There's a tool that, there's a thing that I like to spend time doing just for fun from time to time. There's a thing that we have called Shodan. And Shodan is a tool that it scans the internet for different devices and it kind of looks for vulnerabilities. And every once in a while you'll get a device where there's an open interface. And so you can actually, it will take a screenshot of a desktop environment that's just open. You could connect to it if you want to and you could interact with it if you wanted to. Not legally, of course, but there's all kinds of interesting devices that show up on that. I used to find pharmaceutical machines from time to time where it would have, because of the way that it would take a screenshot, it would have been open on somebody's prescription information with first name, last name, address, phone number, what they came in to order that day, all of that information just displayed on this one screenshot that was taken by a tool. And that's, they've since been doing a better job of that, but it's, anybody can see these things.
Well, that's, you can think of the, again, this is where my brain goes in 50 different directions. Some people might, you can mess with their prescription. I'm not thinking that way. I'm thinking, I could recruit the hell out of that person.
Oh, for sure.
Because if I know they're manic, I know they're bipolar, or if I know that they are depressed or they're taking a certain drug, that I own, like that can be a real problem for them if they're in a certain job or a thing like that. So just privacy and information security has so many parameters that we're not thinking of.
Right.
And you know, it used to be, you know, being gay was the reason you were going to get security clearance. Then it was now more financial stuff, right? If you owe people money. But because so much information or so much of our lives is now attainable by bad people, it becomes the broad counterintelligence perspective of how do we make sure this person is not compromised becomes huge.
Right.
And it never really was that big before.
Yeah. Yeah, there are so many new angles that we have to discover and we have to crash before we can really figure out how to fix it. So including in healthcare, which is really scary to have to say, but the laws behind health and information privacy need to catch up in some respects. There needs to be better auditing behind that thing. Even industrial control systems you can find on the same thing I was telling you about before on Shodan. So every aspect of our lives that has a computer attached to it in some abstract way, needs to be assessed for how it can impact our everyday lives.
You used the word assessed, and this is the last question I'm going to ask, then we'll open it up to the audience for questions. Who does the assessing?
Oh, I do.
Well, I know you do, but like, is the United States government creating, Cyber Command, NSA, they're doing information security stuff, there are defensive people, but that's the primary focus is not to make sure that your medical records get protected. You know, that's being done on the private side, that's being done by CrowdStrike or iDefense or whomever. But who does it in a big picture sense, right? Shouldn't there be an agency, an organization, a conglomerate that's doing this? Because the power of individuals, even big companies, right? If you look at Kaspersky or others, these massive conglomerates, they can't keep up.
Yeah, there's just too much work. Yeah. The NSA apparently is working on creating a division to specifically provide those types of services for the government. They've done this for years, but a more dedicated group apparently is being created for that purpose. There's so much work to do that it has to be a public-private partnership, where the public service side of it is handled by, you know, fantastic people that do a great job, like the National Security Agency and Department of Homeland Security. As far as how that impacts all of us, there are private industry organizations that do the same thing. You might be fascinated to know, actually, the industry is growing in ways that are really interesting to me. If you're a company that wanted to assess the vulnerability of your building, you can hire people that will break into your building for you. You can hire people that will find a way to open a window or break a window, or so we call it social engineering their way into your building, whether it's taking a picture of a badge, which, by the way, don't ever take a picture of what gets you into work and post it anywhere, because that will be used to get into your building.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's why they tell everyone to put your badge away on the metro and all that stuff.
There is a cottage industry of people who go on Instagram just looking for badge pictures that they can, if they're in that line of work, they'll take a picture of it. They'll take that picture that you used, crop it, print it in such a way that will get them into your building. But it's a growing industry with a lot of really interesting people who are all in Las Vegas right now while I'm here. And it's endlessly interesting, especially if you're new to it.
But that's not new in the broader sense. There have been people doing red teaming.
Oh, sure.
For a long time. I mean, military has been doing four operations for decades.
Yep.
Or the National Training Center in the Mojave Desert, in the middle of California, poor Army units and others get sent out there to get their ass kicked by the Op 4, and that's, you know, the way to learn what your vulnerability, what you're bad at, what you're good at, and all these other things. It's nice to see that kind of getting into this domain now, where the best way to learn is kind of practice.
Yeah.
In this case, you learn your vulnerabilities by having them exposed.
Right.
And so you'd rather them be exposed by a company that you're paying versus Iran, you know, or China or someone like that.
Yeah, there's still a lot of heartburn around that. I mean, people are very sensitive about discussing how they will do that against their own sites, because it can be embarrassing, and it can make people a little bit worried to hear, oh, you hired a professional burglar to break into your building? What does that mean for me? So those questions have to be, I think, on all of our parts, we have to understand how security applies to our own personal information so that we don't have that kind of, like, we call it FUD, fear and uncertainty and doubt about everything that occurs, because it's not all scary. It's not all spooky. It's a part of what we have to do to protect ourselves. And it doesn't have to be scary. It's a fairly normal part of life in most cases these days.
Well, and I think that's what people probably will eventually need to realize. It's like you lock your door.
Right.
You don't think about why you lock your door.
Right.
You just lock your door. It's not that, you know, if you go through the process of being, so I don't have an axe murderer come in and chop me up at night, you just know at the end of the day you lock your door.
Right.
Well, we need to have that same kind of security when we're thinking about computers and our phones and everything else. And, you know, we put a seatbelt on. We don't expect to get in a car accident.
Right.
We probably never will.
But we do increasingly expect that companies will do that for us.
Yes.
So whenever a breach occurs, we all get kind of angry and like, oh, I can't believe that this company that I trusted would lose all of my personal information. But the reality is that we entrust that to them. And everything that goes along with it. We expect them to do the things that we don't understand. Hire that burglar to break into your building because I don't know anything about that. And so
there, yeah, Target, you sell me $4 socks. Here's all my information. You protect it.
But some of it we give away freely too. Right. And
that's an entire another hour conversation. So let me open up to anyone who has a question from the audience. There is a microphone there. So if you do, just come on down and ask a question into the microphone, so we can pick it up and so we can hear it.
Hi. Good evening. Thank you for coming out and talking to us about this topic. One of the things that strikes me is that one of our biggest vulnerabilities isn't at the federal government, because there's a lot of resources that are going into that with NSA and Cybercom and such. But we see some cases, for example, ransomware that have hit, I believe, Atlanta and Baltimore and things like that, and that's, you know, then you look at some of the infrastructure you're talking about, power plants and utility distribution systems, communication systems, and those are all decentralized out there. Obviously, things like how NSA is doing business and CyberO and CyberD is very highly classified, but there, it seems like the information sharing of those technologies where the resources are developing it would be problematical with how do you push that down to levels where, you know, the security isn't quite as robust as at perhaps the federal government level. What would be your thoughts on that, that could do something to mitigate those threat levels that we're seeing at state and municipal levels?
So assessments are a very good response to that. So you brought up Baltimore specifically in Atlanta. Mm-hmm. That ongoing process of doing assessments against your own infrastructure is something, like I said, people have to do it. It's expected by the people of Baltimore and Atlanta that the people who run these systems understand what they have and what they have, what's available to them, what they have to engineer, and what has to be protected. There needs to be more focus on that, and until there is, we're going to see more high-profile hacks like that. I mean, it's just
how important is redundancy, like offline redundancy. I mean, you look at a lot of the power grid protections are being designed behind. Yeah, you might be able to hack in and do some damage for 10 minutes.
Yeah,
because after that, we're just going to reroute it from a non-network redundant system. So you know, the end of the civilization is never going to happen.
Yeah,
because we've got something that can't be hacked.
Yeah.
You know, and that was the whole idea about, like, people joked about our ICBM silos are still targeted with these huge, not even like the 3x5 floppies. We're like the big ones.
Yes.
And like, that's so old. Like, yeah, because you can't hack it.
Right.
Right.
Well, the interesting thing there is that there are two worlds. There are two big worlds in information security as far as I see it. There's the information technology world and there's the operational technology world. And redundancy is something that you can do with information, with data. You can back up your information. What you can't do is back up like a conveyor belt system. So you only have one of those. And if you only have one, unless you have multiple layers of redundancy to do something like fill your Coke bottles, for instance, if you don't have multiple conveyor belts to pick up the slack, one conveyor belt going out is going to impact your business. So it's kind of a different paradigm than we generally think about. But if that gets compromised through some cyber means, or even in something more innocent like a PLC just stops working, that becomes a big issue, and your ability to make money for that amount of time is shut down.
Right. Yes, ma'am.
Hi.
Sorry, it's kind of high.
Really high. Hi. Do you buy stocks at Target? Do you do that? I mean, I think my question is, I feel like it's really hard to always get everything you want without going out and, you know, putting your information out on the internet. So do you guys do that, or is it like terrifying to you and you don't do it? And if you do, what steps do you take to protect yourself?
I think I might have missed the basic question.
Like, do you shop at Target?
Do you shop at Target online and put your information online?
Like how much, because how can you avoid terms of service for just Facebook? It's basically, we can use this any way we want to.
Yeah, gosh, I'm a human. So I do. Yes, I do. Because it's hard to avoid in the modern world, and I also have two kids. So we have to deal with all of the things that go along with just living life.
Right.
Occasionally, you do have to accept the risk. That's the term that we use in the business. You know that there is a problem. You have to just accept that from time to time, somebody's going to steal your credit card information and you're going to have to get a new credit card. That amount of risk and mitigation is thankfully absorbed by the credit companies these days. So if somebody goes and buys $600 worth of tires in Idaho, because that never happened to me before recently, you just get a new card and you move on with your life. That doesn't mean that you don't protect yourself. It just means you become aware of what your threats are.
That means you don't go on Facebook during your vacation and say, we're on vacation.
Yeah, who are we talking about right now?
No, I know. There might be a colleague who works here that's doing that right now.
Don't post your pictures, Jackie.
Don't post your pictures while you're on vacation thousands of miles away. Yes, sir.
Hi. I do work in HR, and I can agree with you guys on the healthcare aspect of it. Now, in the sense that employers can't deny employees being hired for certain jobs or being promoted. However, healthcare insurance companies are using the smoking cessation test now, where they're able to determine if a person has been a smoker and if they are continuing to be a smoker, and they can actually increase their rates. So I completely understand where you guys are coming from, and unfortunately, it is happening. My question is, going back to Nemesis, and then also with the other example of Skynet, so I guess going to the movies, like with like Minority Report with pre-crime, what's the likelihood of something like that ever coming into fruition?
Oh gosh, you just opened a whole can of worms. Yeah. I'm going to try and keep this short. I have a theory that we won't see the type of thing that you see with Skynet. In the way that I define something like Skynet, it's like a malicious artificial intelligence that's bent on killing all humans. I think that we probably see, and I'm kind of taking the piss here, I think that we probably see sad computers developed before we actually see, like, intentionally malicious, independent intelligence.
So now Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy version
Sad, yeah. Yeah, I think there's some legitimacy to that, because you have to have self-aware machines first before you have a machine that's able to, like, self-aware in the science fiction aspect, before you have a machine that can just on its own decide that it's going to kill people. What scares me is that we're using artificial intelligence in ways that are immediately threatening to not just our social order. There are all kinds of AI technologies right now that are being used to do things like predictive policing, which is I don't know why we need to be more careful about how we use that information, because it takes historic data and it makes policing decisions based on what neighborhoods have been bad in the past. And that's just perpetuating all kinds of different race issues that we already have that we need to deal with as humans, and we are making the machines inherit that. So that, to me, my concern is more how we use artificial intelligence in that capacity rather than avoiding flying robots that want to murder us.
Well, I mean, wouldn't flying robots that want to murder us be a result of the programmer kind of programming their own kind of personalities? Into it.
Yeah.
So you've got some kind of sadistic guy who didn't get a lot of dates growing up, who spent a lot of time in his mom's basement covered in Cheeto dust, that's designing this system, and that personality is being kind of turned into that.
Yeah.
You know.
Well, that would be not an independent type of intelligence. So there is a distinct difference between the two.
Hi. I know you touched on this briefly, but I was just curious with the example set, for instance, with 8chan recently, where they were kind of hounded off the internet, to your point. But what I was really fascinated by was the fact that basically the unilaterally Cloudflare was able to make the decision essentially to take them offline.
Right.
I was just curious what your thoughts are on that precedent that was set. Does there need to be sort of a larger governing organization, or kind of what will that lead to going forward?
So there are a lot of things that I could say about that. What I will say is that there is a difference between governmental governments, U.S. government managing information and the way that we manage information and do information and share information. And there's a difference between that and the way that companies reserve the right to host certain content. Facebook does not have the same kind of responsibility to protect what we interpret as First Amendment rights. Like it or not, that they don't have any responsibility to protect that. The U.S. government certainly does.
Right.
But then you're talking about regulations. And if you're not okay with regulation, then you definitely don't want the government to be in the business of telling Facebook what they can and can't host. So it's a sticky topic right now, but it's definitely one that requires more analysis.
Yeah. Right, last question.
Yeah, so Vince briefly mentioned the gaming industry, which kind of goes back to the media presenting the mass shootings. What role does cybersecurity play in preventing mass shootings, such as the ones that happened in Dayton and El Paso this last weekend?
I don't know if you saw that they're saying they're having a hard time opening the phone of the Dayton shooter.
Oh, gosh,
yeah. And we're going back to San Bernardino with the whole FBI versus...
Yeah,
and the manifesto that was posted online for the El Paso shooter.
Yeah, that again opens so many different topics. There's been a discussion, a very public discussion, about the difference between the idea of putting backdoors in encryption, for instance, and that touches the whole iPhone debate almost directly. Where we deal with that as individual citizens is to kind of look at the way that we use encryption and say, is this something that we all need? Yes. We need to have some form of encryption so that we can do even basic things that we all take for granted, like password protection. Back about 15, 20 years ago, it wasn't common to have secured HTTP, for instance. So it was very easy to just intercept HTTP traffic, and passwords were sent in clear text in a lot of cases. We've grown away from that only because encryption is more ubiquitous. So to the extent that FBI should be able to, or any governmental organization should be able to backdoor our security for the purpose of protecting us, I think is another one of those security versus personal privacy issues that we kind of contended with after USA Patriot and then the FISA Amendments Act later on. It's one of those questions that I think we have to find better answers to with every new question that occurs, that comes up.
And I'll just end this. We haven't had the debate, right? I mean, when it was FBI versus Apple, it was a court case, it was about 2 weeks, and then it was over.
Yep.
Because FBI lost, and then they just had...
They found a way in.
But they tried to do it legally, but... This sounds like this is something we should be debating over a year. Like, where are we coming down on privacy versus security? Where are we? Is it court orders? Is it something where after the fact you right. can go in? I mean, what if there's a clear and present danger?
Yes.
What if you think there are accomplices out there?
Yeah.
What we now that people being arrested around the country who looked at the shooting in El Paso and were inspired by it.
Yeah.
What if we want to get inside their phones to stop them from doing it? Where is that line? This is not a new debate,
right?
This is not just because of cyber.
Yeah.
This goes back to kind of the beginning of time,
yeah.
or the idea of listening into conversations yeah. and all this other stuff. We just never had the conversation. It was 2 weeks.
Right.
There's a really interesting court case going yeah. on between Jim Comey and Apple, and then it was over.
Yeah.
And then we stopped talking about
yep.
it. And that to me is problematic.
Yeah, we're just waiting for that thing to come back up. It's gonna come up again.
Yep.
Sometime. Sooner or later, we're going to have to deal with that again, and yep. it's a right now problem.
Well, Emily, thank you so much for joining us here
at
the podcast.
Thank you for
inviting me. Appreciate you taking the time. Thank you all for being here as well.
Thank you for listening to SpyCast. Remember, every Tuesday we will post a new podcast available from both SpyMuseum.org and iTunes. If you have any questions or comments about SpyCast, email us at spycast@spymuseum.org. or leave a comment or review on our iTunes page. You can also follow us on Twitter at @INTLSpycast. That's INTLSpycast. Talk to you next week.